want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to the latest rants and ravings from Peter B. Collins. Supported by great listeners like Janet Price, Mary Gruber, Andrew Rush, and Kathleen Emmer. If you'd like to help and you're able, go to my website. Voluntary subscriptions start at just $5 a month. The links are on the right-hand side of the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Coming up in our second segment, Jay Behader will join us. His book is called The Pirates of Somalia. And, you know, the Gulf of Aden is a dangerous place. There are a lot of reasons why Somali pirates have been raiding those ships and demanding ransom money. You'll get the story that the corporate media hasn't brought you coming up later in this podcast. And Gary Chu has a review of the latest George Clooney vehicle called Descendants. But first, we're going to take a look at the American surveillance machinery and how one American has taken on the watchful eyes of Big Brother by monitoring his own every move. This is an amazing story. Joining me now is Hassan Elahi. He is a professor and an interdisciplinary artist based at the University of Maryland in College Park. And he has performed or produced art exhibits based on surveillance, simulated time, transport systems, borders. And he then had his own encounter with airport security, the wonderful Transportation Security Authority, when they challenged him as he entered the country after performing being at an art exhibit outside the country. And Professor, explain to us what that encounter was about and what it led to.
Sure. Well, you know, this is pre-TSA, actually. So.
This is the old airline employees who were doing the security up until the Department of Homeland Security kicked in?
This was actually not leaving the U.S., this was returning to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So as I'm getting off the plane, I get, it was the old Immigration Naturalization Service, INS.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So, which has now been folded into CBP and Homeland
ICE.
Security and all that.
Yeah.
But so as I come in, it's really unusual for U.S. citizens holding a U.S. passport to be taken in by Immigration and Naturalization Services. You know, it's really, it just doesn't make any sense, but I was taken in by them and then walked through a rat maze and then given over to the FBI and an FBI agent at the Detroit airport in June of 2002 questioned me on my whereabouts, why I was there, who I meet with, who pays for my trips, all sorts of little details. And then literally just out of nowhere as he's questioning me, he asks me, where were you September 12th? And, of course, I'm trying to think back. Well, I don't exactly remember, but I can look it up for you. So I pull out an old PDA, and I said, okay, let's look up my appointments for the 12th, and then we read them. Let's look up my appointments for the 11th, the 10th, the 19th, the 28th. We read about 6 months of my calendar. And I don't think he was expecting me to have such detailed records, but fortunately I did, because it could have ended up really messy. But I think really anyone that talks to me for more than a minute realizes I'm no terrorist threat. And the FBI.
But you have a name that's not John Smith, doesn't sound American. Nobody calls you Jimmy, do they?
Yeah, right? You know, it's it's one of those things that of course, you know, we, of course, everyone, every American at some point in history had a funny name. So let's backtrack a little bit on that one. But really, mm-hmm. what had happened is, it wasn't a case of mistaken identity. It wasn't a case of someone with a similar name. The authorities had received a report that an Arab man had fled on September 12th who was hoarding explosives. No, never mind, I'm not Arab. Never mind, it wasn't the 12th. Never mind, it wasn't explosives. But it doesn't matter. You know, it's one of those, if you see something, say something. And even if it's wrong, if you see something, say something. And I got caught up in this. And I think the thing is, this FBI agent, he knew right away that I was completely harmless. And logic would have told him, hey, this guy is completely innocent. Leave him alone. This is a bogus tip. This is not real. But, of course, he didn't have the authority to act on that. Instead, he had to send this up further down the chain. He did let me go home. He said, someone from the Tampa office, which is where I was living at the time, will follow up with you, and they will take care of this.
Mm-hmm.
So this went on for 6 months, on and off, going back and forth to the offices, getting phone calls. Finally ended with 9 consecutive polygraphs. And again, I mean, anywhere along the way, everyone that talked to me, you realize that, they knew that I was, at least I hope they knew I was innocent, but the system didn't allow them to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what? This is a waste of time. But no, we have to go through the process. We have to go through the whole cycle. I mean, think about how much energy and resources we're wasting by this ridiculously archaic system.
Well, and it shows that our authorities, including those who work at airports, whether it's TSA or on the immigration side when you're entering the country, are not very well trained. And apparently can only figure out American, not American. And they try to push people into one of those two categories. And clearly, we're a very diverse country with citizens, those who were born here, those who have become citizens, who have a wide range of backgrounds. And one of the most common cases of misidentification is Sikhs, who wear rather distinctive turbans, who are often mistaken by ignorant Americans for Arabs. I mean, that's one of the most glaring examples.
I mean, ethnically, there's really not much similarity. Linguistically, there's no similarity. Culturally, there's no similarity. Oh, but they wear a turban, so they must be the same. You know, we're kind of operating on this really ignorant attitude that, everyone over there, they're all the same. You know, the fact that I got reported as an Arab man, I mean, okay, so I was born in Bangladesh, but I grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in New York City, and I came here when I was like 7 years old. So my association with Bangladesh is about the same as my association with like Greenland or Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I mean, I'm from Brooklyn, and the fact that they couldn't put two and two together, it's of course on paper I look very different than I do in person, and then of course culturally it's a completely different. Completely different story there. But again, it's one of those things where people get paranoid, people panic. Now,
Well, okay. Didn't you get pissed off when they treated you this way, when they kept coming back and asking you stupid questions?
Well, of course you get pissed off the first couple of days, but then what? And then what do you do? I mean, that doesn't really solve anything. So then I started thinking to myself, well, how do I get out of this? How do I convince these guys, look, I'm innocent? And I think that the initial reaction is, how dare you accuse me? But instead of that, my response was, well, how can I help you? What can I do? What can I do to convince you that I really am innocent? And so it wasn't a matter of fighting them, because at the end of the day, I mean, I could have said, screw you guys, this isn't legal, I'm getting a lawyer. But I also had enough sense to know that whatever was happening outside the law, and the law did not matter. You know, you have this magic wand of national security and terrorism. You know, that thing called the Constitution and the legal procedure, that all goes out the window. That doesn't mean a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
and your ability to enforce your constitutional rights is often linked to the size of your savings account.
Possibly, but over that, at that thing, I mean, forget constitutional right. That's not what's in your head at that moment. What's in your head at that moment is, how do I get out of this situation? And you really do not behave like a rational human being, and you really revert to very animalistic instincts and instincts of of survival. You do whatever this animal has to do to survive. And in my case, survival literally meant cooperate.
Mm-hmm.
Cooperate. Tell them everything. So they would ask me a question, and I've made sure to tell them every detail of everything. And, of course, you know, I didn't hold back anything. And of course, after, you know, months of going back and forth, I told them everything. And, you know, I'm all about full disclosure here. So, mm-hmm. They would ask me one question, and I would answer for the next 15 minutes just talking about all sorts of little details about, well, you know, then I went there, then I met this person at this bar, and then we went to, got some roasted chicken there, then we went to this club afterwards, and then I went to this hotel room, then I slept there, and the next morning I got on this bus and went to this city. I threaded all these things because I had all this record on whether it would be my phone or whether it would be my appointment calendar or whether it would be my photographs that timestamp everything.
Mm-hmm.
So realistically, you know, so after the 9 polygraphs, one of the things that I started thinking is like, well, guys, all we need is the last guy at the last airport not to get the last memo, and here we go all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the FBI said, well, you know, if you get into trouble, here's some phone numbers, give us a call, we'll take care of it. So ever since that moment, before I would go anywhere, I would tell the FBI. And it's not because I had to, but I chose to.
And do you have a personal agent that you can call and say, Bob?
Yes.
You do?
Well, I mean, at this moment, you know, this is 9 years later, I don't call him directly,
mm-hmm.
but now I've decided to communicate with him openly. And the part of that communication, so basically the phone calls turned to emails, and the emails got longer and longer with pictures, with websites that I would make. And then I decided that I was going to not only tell the FBI, but I was going to tell everyone along with the FBI. So that way not mm-hmm. only did the FBI agent could look me up, but so could anyone else out there.
And in fact, I'm monitoring you right now, and mm-hmm. I know exactly where you are. You're on the campus of the University of Maryland.
Yes.
And your website refreshes, it changes the pictures, some to archival shots, and then it seems to, about every 5 minutes, take me back to the University of Maryland, where I'm looking at a very imposing building, an academic building.
That's the building I'm in right now.
Uh-huh.
So what you're basically seeing is, okay, so you have a live image up on top with a map,
mm-hmm.
Pointing in that flashing red arrow that you're seeing.
Right.
That pixel is me.
Uh-huh.
So basically what I've developed, and again, I developed this in 2003, so this is not anything... I mean, of course, now it's like, what's the big deal? So it sounds like Foursquare, or I do this every day when I check in on Facebook. But this was in 2003 where the technology was very different. And what I decided is I turned my cell phone into sort of a tracking device. I wrote some software, and I was able to create the system that allowed me to share my whereabouts. It allowed me to share photographs of where I of every little detail of my life. And of course, you know, because I timestamp my life every few moments, all those images are uploaded. And what you're seeing is archives of my databases. So you'll see every meal that I've eaten.
You've had a lot of interesting food, Professor. I'm hungry just looking at these dishes. I see a lot of curry, a lot of rice.
Well, you know, I travel a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I travel a lot, so you'll see all sorts of different types of things there. You'll see empty train stations. You'll see parking lots off of Interstate 80. You'll see gas stations.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see stores that I buy my duck paste at.
Oh, here's a toilet. Thank you for sharing.
Well, you know, I'm all about full disclosure. you know, it's like, guys, you want to watch me? Perfectly okay. I'm okay with that. Hey, look.
The lid was up. The seat was down. He's a gentleman.
Yeah, you know, I'm okay. I'm okay about them watching me. But you know what? I can watch myself better than those guys ever could.
Uh huh.
And I could get such a level of detail, like that toilet. You know, I can get such a level of detail that no one will ever have access to that level of detail.
Now, Professor, I want to provide people with the link, and I'll put it in the show file at peterbcollins.com, so you can easily link to the website that we're talking about right now. But it's available on the web, and the address is trackingtranscience.net. And I want to spell transience for you, TRANSIENCE.
Yep.
Trackingtranscience.net. What does that mean?
Well, you know, it's a movement. So one of the things that had happened was, now, keep in mind, so I'm thinking back to, so when I first started this project, the last thing on my mind was, hey, I got new artwork here. This was not meant as artwork. This was a very pragmatic decision on my part to contact the FBI and report in my whereabouts and tell everyone just to make sure that I had all my friends and many hundreds and now hundreds of thousands of eyes constantly watching me, you know, in case I were to disappear. You know, if my map didn't update for 3 days, we know that something happened in this building that I'm in right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so in one of my questionings when I was flying back, I saw a piece of paper that had three names on it that I think at that time this was CBP. It was post 2005, so it was CBP. And I'm looking at the three names, and there were names, birth dates, and nationalities, and then the reason why they should be stopped. And all three of us had Muslim-sounding names. One person was in Saudi Arabia, one person was from Pakistan, and the third one was me, and it said USA. And then there was the reasons why each of these people should be stopped. You know, I know I'm not supposed to see this paper, but they're so sloppy. I mean, they're just putting it out there. And I see the first one. The first one was a convicted armed smuggler. The second one just said classified Secret Service active or something like that. And mine, next to my name, it said suspicious movement after 9/11.
Wow.
You know, what exactly is suspicious movement? You know, does it mean that, you know, that I walked funny, that I stepped off the plane in a suspicious manner?
You went to the Ministry of Silly Walks. And graduated.
Limp? Is that suspicious movement? I mean, what is suspicious movement? And of course, because I travel so much for my work, it was one of those situations where, like, well, you know, if you travel too much, of course you must be trouble. You know, of course, in the same reasoning, if you take out too many books from the library, you're also just as much of a suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Why else would someone do this? Why else would people travel? So you know, unless you're up to no good. So a lot of the tracking that I started doing is because I do move around. And really, I mean, at any moment, something could happen. So this was a very pragmatic way for me to not only to let the FBI know, but also let people close to me, my friends and family, know where I was and what I was doing. And then it slowly evolved from that into this pretty elaborate art project. And then it also went back to the circle of now, you know, when I first started this project, people thought I was crazy. Why would you tell everyone every little detail that you're doing? Well, now there's 800 million people just on Facebook alone doing this, or essentially, you know, similar things. Every time they update their status, or every time they poke somebody, or every time they upload a photo.
Right.
So now let's put that in perspective. You know, 800 million, it just sounds like a really big number.
Well, TMI is a problem across the board. There are people sharing way too much information.
Yeah.
And I use Twitter a little bit, but I do find that people are often tweeting me about things that I just don't care about.
Exactly. And what do you
and
do? You
ignore
them.
It's a level of detail that I never aspired to.
Yeah. But the great thing, though, is in this real bizarre way of me putting all this information out there, I actually live a really anonymous and private life. And I've come to the realization that the way you protect your identity in an age where everything is archived, everything is tracked, everything is indexed, the way you really protect yourself and the way you remain private is not by disconnecting. You do not have a choice. You may not post anything about you, but other people will. Other companies will. You know, we're not going to give up our cell phones. We're not going to go live in a bunker and completely isolate from the rest of the world. That's just not going to happen. But one way to do it is by, if you want to live a private life, you should just put it out in the open and no one will want it. People will leave you alone. No one wants to see my toilets. But they're there.
Well, I hear your argument, and I think it's really a compelling and thought-provoking. And, you know, when I think about the idea that somebody wants to tap my phone or go through my garbage, on one hand, I say, go ahead. You're not going to find anything.
Yeah.
But I really feel violated because of the principles that used to apply, that I had a right to privacy absent to probable cause and a court order to go through my garbage or to listen to my phone calls. And I know that the NSA is intercepting this call between you and me right now.
Well, they're right down the street from here.
Well, that's
right.
Practically
across the street.
You're pretty close to Fort Meade.
Yes.
And maybe that motel where some of the hijackers spent the night before 9/11 when you were out of the country.
I hope not. No, but, you know, I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned that. Okay, so we're talking about, say, you know, looking through your trash. And if you only have, a, you know, 10 or 20 pieces of trash, yeah, it's pretty easy to go through that. If you're generating 30 dumpsters trash every week. Yeah, go ahead. Go figure. Go try to dig through that. By the time you're done through the first half of the dumpster, there'll be five more that'll show up.
Uh huh.
So, at a certain point, what I'm basically doing is I'm borrowing the simplest of all economics principles, and I'm analogizing that to the idea that intelligence agencies, and it doesn't matter who that intelligence agency is, they all operate in an industry where their commodity, their currency, is information. And the reason the information has value is because no one else has access to it. And by me flooding the market and giving everyone that information, the information that the FBI has about me has zero value. And thus, by me putting it all out there, I'm symbolically devaluing their currency.
No. And I'm processing this because it's counterintuitive, and I'm still digging in, Professor. I'm still saying, give me back my rights. Don't take away my privacy.
Well, it's okay. You can have your rights, and you could have your privacy by going around it, by giving them what they want.
Mm-hmm.
They want this, give it to them. And you know what? Don't stop giving it to them. Give them more and more and more.
Now, I just saw the toilet page flash by again with 14 or 16 different bathroom scenes. Tell us a little bit about your personal discipline, because, I occasionally take photos with my phone, mm-hmm. But I don't think to track every step of every day. So how do you manage to do this without spending all your time focused on recording what you're doing?
Oh, it's no different than sending a text message. It's no different than checking your email. It's no different than sending a tweet. I mean, this is something that we do all the time. And you know, we got by just fine before we did all this, but we've adapted. So now it's no different. I mean, when we get a text message, we don't say, "Oh, there's a text message that showed up on my phone. I have to take my phone out and I have to go through these menus and I have to respond to this and I have to hit send." We don't think about it. We've internalized it, and in the same way, I take the photo. I hit a couple of buttons on my phone, and it automatically goes up, and it's there. So, and of course, when I'm photographing, it's become such an instinct that I don't even think about it anymore. It, mm-hmm. it just happens. So, sure, I used to. I'm a pretty meticulous record keeper to begin with, but the sequence of these records, of this, actually, if you want to look at it, pieces of evidence,
mm-hmm.
because what you're really looking at is really clinical pieces of evidence. There's the photos are not editorialized at all. They're very, very much this, you know, it's very much a document.
Right, and there are a few beauty shots, but that appears to be accidental.
Well, no. Hey, I'm an artist here, you know, so I'm working on that.
Well, the food pictures are really delightful, but some of them are much more evidence, like surveillance camera footage.
Yeah, and a lot of that is also because of the technology. Now, I've been photographing these for years, and of course, the camera technology has changed over the years too. So before, I used to have really clunky old cameras, and now cell phone cameras are amazing. The quality is just phenomenal. So here's the other thing that we used to historically fear cameras. We don't have to fear cameras anymore. Now it's a matter of turning that camera around. We all are walking around with a camera at any given moment. You know, good luck trying to buy a phone these days where there is no camera on it.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of fearing that camera, instead of fearing Big Brother's camera, there's a million little brothers that can point that camera back out. And we're seeing this. We're seeing this all over the world. We're seeing this everywhere where these tiny bits and pieces of information are all coming together. Okay, historically, yes, sure, the authorities would take away your camera. Well, these days, take it away. By the time you've taken it away, there's a photo. That photo, first of all, is already on Flickr. Mm-hmm. And second, there's another camera taking picture of the camera being taken away.
Well, we're seeing that in the Occupy protests, too. Even when Mayor Bloomberg set it up and he sent a CBS helicopter away from the scene, or somebody did. He may not have done it personally. But they raided the Camp Zuccotti, Park Zuccotti, in the middle of the night. Yeah. But I watched it live on a stream.
Exactly.
And I didn't need a network. I didn't need a hairdo correspondent to stand there and tell me what was going on. This was just live, raw footage from people's camera phones.
Exactly. And another thing that's happening, for the first time in history, we're seeing almost as many producers of media as consumers of media. Historically, you had a handful of producers and a huge number of consumers. We are seeing a reversal of that power. We do not need that one main camera to tell us what it is. No, there's millions of little ones, and that can all get you the information that you want. So in a way, because we're all producing so much information, and all that information is being archived, and all that information is being recorded, how do you remain private? And my logic was that, well, the way you become private is that you don't. You just give it up. And then in this wall of noise, because there's so much noise, you can actually lay low underneath that. There's very little that you know about my private life, even though you're seeing every bit of my life there.
Well, I can tell you that you're a real active sleeper, because all of these beds are really ripped up, but there's no evidence that there was another person in that bed with you.
Exactly. and I'm not going to tell you that, but I'm going to give you that information. But here's the other interesting thing. So, you know, I'm giving you all this information, but this isn't anything new, though. I mean, trial lawyers have been doing this forever. Oh, you need that piece of evidence? Here's 16,000 pages. It may be four lines in that 16,000 pages.
Well, the government, when they want to bury something, they dump documents Friday at 5 p.m. in huge quantities.
Yeah, it's a data dump. Mm-hmm. And I'm borrowing that exact same principle, except I'm doing it.
All right, you have really changed my thinking here, Professor, this is somewhat profound, because I'm the kind of guy who, when I cross the Golden Gate Bridge and I've got the fast-track toll collector, I think, wow, there's a record that I was here. Who do I want not to know about this? And on my iPhone, when it pops up and says Google wants to know my location, I always say no. Even if it hurts me trying to figure out a mapping, situation of where I want to go. So I'm one of these people who's been hunkered down, not quite cowering, but, trying to avoid creating any kind of a profile. When I go to the airport, I have to control myself, no jokes, no outbursts, and I always tell myself, act like Jell-O.
But, compliance could be a very effective tool of resistance. And in my case, I look at it as aggressive compliance. Mm-hmm. You want me to comply? I will. And I'm going to take it to such a level that I'm going to be completely useless. I'm so helpful that I'm pretty much unhelpful.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, now, Professor, before we wrap up here, I want to ask you to apply your conceptual approach to this to a thorny issue that I just found out about recently. And I want to credit Pam Martins, who's an independent journalist who published a story in Counterpunch that was then picked up by Alternet. And what she details is the Lower Manhattan Security Initiative. There are more than 2,000 private spy cameras that are owned by the Wall Street firms, the banksters, as if they're, sitting on tons of gold or gems, in their buildings.
They are.
And there are another 1,000 cameras owned by the New York Police Department. So 3,000 cameras in Lower Manhattan alone. And all of these videos are fed into a common command center where the police department allows representatives of the security departments of the big Wall Street firms to work alongside the cops. So you've got a goon from Goldman Sachs and one from Citigroup sitting next to a detective or officer of the New York Police Department. And I find this kind of pervasive surveillance to be, you know, nauseating. I think it's unconstitutional and un-American, and that they have used the events of 9/11 to basically pacify the American people into accepting a growing police state. And so when I look at this collusion between government and business, the word fascism surfaces, and so my resistance grows. But I want you to help me through a little therapy here. How would you approach Lower Manhattan, knowing that there are 3,000 cameras and that the security, private security, and the public officials have the same access to that information?
Well, first of all, it is humanly not possible to process 3,000 cameras simultaneously. So there's actually not a person looking at this. It's probably a machine doing this, and the machine is looking for things that fit out of the norm. Because you simply cannot, the human brain simply cannot process that type of information coming in simultaneously. So, yes, so what's happening is it's probably a boring computer that's just watching all of these things. But on the other hand, when you're looking at this type of massive surveillance, one of the things that's kind of interesting that many years ago, people were noticing that there were EasyPass readers in many parts of cities where there are no tolls.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, the city says, well, you know, we're doing transportation research. We want to know what type of, you know, if we need to increase traffic or something. But, of course, the other side of that is, well, we know that if you're here at this time and you're over there at this time, you can't possibly be in between of this time. So there's only a few limited places. So, it is really concerning, particularly when you have a privatization or, more appropriately, a militarization of public space.
Mm-hmm.
But the way you regain public space is instead of fighting it, you join it. You join it and you turn that thing around. One of the things that happened this morning that I thought was brilliant when I was hearing on the news coming in this morning when I was driving in was that people at the Occupy Wall Street protest, they were planning on going to the protest in business suits. So that way, the police didn't know who was going to work and who was going to the park.
Uh-huh.
So, again, there's many ways of compliance. And in that compliance, you could actually be resisting. And we don't, you know, resistance doesn't have to take a monolithic, singular definition. There are many ways of looking at this information. And I think this is where it gets really interesting, because I think, as an artist, I mean, I'm not sure if my work is still art or if it ever was, but I think, because, you know, in my life, I can't tell when I'm working as an artist and when I'm not. The difference between work and life, there is no distinction.
Mm-hmm.
The two are exactly the same. So I think one of the things that artists have a luxury of is that we're able to look at things from very circular routes, or we don't often go for the most direct result. And because we avoid the most direct and most efficient way, and sometimes we go the most inefficient and most counterintuitive way, and sometimes by going through that process, it actually becomes something completely unexpected. And often the person or the organization or the entity that you're resisting against often doesn't know what to do, because this is not something that they've thought about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a perfect example of this, when I was being questioned by the FBI, one of the things that I made sure that I would answer, I remember very clearly that I was asked a question, and I made a reference to the Florida State football game that took place the previous weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Middle Eastern terrorist suspects are not supposed to know about college football, or much less the nuances between the SEC and the ACC.
Uh-huh.
So at that moment, they have to treat you as one of their own. You're not this outsider person. So it wasn't necessarily my fluency in the language, but it was really my fluency in the culture.
Yeah.
So I think if we actually are able to look at cultural responses and not necessarily say try to counter military response, because we're not going to win that game.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have that. We know who has the advantage there. We know who has the advantage in the traditional power structure. But if we approach it from a completely unexpected way, we can actually make things happen.
Now, you mentioned that millions of Americans and, in fact, people all over the world are disclosing much more about themselves through Facebook and other social networking devices. But let me take the example of the Manhattan Security Initiative and add in smartphones with GPS tracking.
Yeah.
And we learned recently, this was in the New York Times and didn't get a lot of attention, but a group in Germany that's roughly, I would call it the equivalent of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, has sued the government, claiming that the government has figured out ways that they can remotely activate the camera on your laptop or your phone and monitor without your knowledge. I know that, for example, from one individual case, that the Department of Homeland Security has some sort of an understanding with General Motors, and that they can use the OnStar system not only to track a suspect vehicle, but to actually listen in surreptitiously to the conversations of the people in that vehicle. So I don't think it takes a great deal of paranoia to understand how the technology works and what the government is capable of today. So when we add in our smartphones where we're serving up the information that can be used to track us and to collect other data about us, at what point do we have to say, well, this too much information approach won't work because they are able to find me a needle in the haystack of Lower Manhattan and I'm giving them the information from my own phone?
But this is assuming that every piece of information you produce is valuable. So if they are on listening to you on OnStar, if you're constantly blabbering about things that completely make sense at times and yet do not make sense at others, someone's going to have to sit there and filter through all that junk.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're constantly talking to yourself, someone's going to eventually give up. You know, it's not worth it. It's not worth going through every bit of it. Now, I realize we have machines that can really go through and analyze some of these things, and there are people working in metaphor research and linguistic research that are trying to decode these types of communications. But we're still relatively far from that.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the moment, you know, we really shouldn't feel that everything that we say is of such importance that you know, if you're only providing bits and pieces, if you're only putting tiny bits of information, you're a much easier target. Take for example, you know, you put your name in Google. The first thing that pops up is not the most flattering thing. You can't tell Google to delete it. But instead of deleting it, you could generate 40 pages of information and bury that. So it goes back to the same thing. Okay, so if you're only having that one conversation in that car, yes, that's going to be important because that's the only thing that stands out. But if you're having zillions of conversations and only one or two of those are really important,
mm-hmm.
it's going to take a lot of skills for someone to decipher what is important and what isn't. And really what that does is by putting all this out there, forces a restructuring of the intelligence agencies. I mean, you know, if you look at it this way, East Germany, during the Stasi days, 1 in 12 of the population were Stasi informants.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a sustainable economy. You know, it did not work out very well for East Germany. So this type of, you know, constantly having this this police state of constant surveillance, it's not going to work. So, and particularly if there's so much information, I mean, you know, I've come to the premise that if 300 million people started doing what I'm doing, we would potentially need another 300 to 600 to 900 million people just to keep up with the data.
Well, you've really opened my mind here, Professor, and I want to thank you. And this started with an op-ed that you published in the New York Times on October 30th. What kind of reaction did you get from that?
You know, the Times is an interesting publication because it is really an international response that I get. And some were very hostile towards me, but nonetheless, I think most of the people were quite supportive. Now, interestingly enough, that same article also got reprinted in the Dallas Morning News. And, of course, you could imagine the readership of the Dallas Morning News is a little different than the New York Times.
I guess.
And I'm actually quite excited because I think George W. Bush actually had it in his hands.
Mm-hmm.
So and, I was and really do you curious think that, knowing what he thinks about it.
Do you think that the guy who reads stuff to Rick Perry went over to Bush's house and read it to him?
Well, I mean, I'm hopeful. I'm really hopeful. You know, but here's the interesting thing. Now, I don't know whether Bush read it or not, but when I look through the log files of my website, I do see a lot of three-letter agencies, and one of them being EOP, which is Executive Office of the President.
Yeah.
Now, and these guys have been coming in for a while. And again, I don't know if it's Bush. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. You know, it could be an intern. And if it's Dick Cheney, I'm really scared.
Yeah, he's looking for a heart donor.
We don't know. You know, we don't know why they're watching, but they are. You know, so it's really hard to be accused of being paranoid when you indeed have proof that they are watching.
Indeed. Professor, I've really enjoyed talking with you, and as I've said, this is really thought-provoking, and I may actually change my behavior and start supplying them with an overload of data. Hassan Alahi from the University of Maryland, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Still to come on the Peter B. Collins Show today, our official film reviewer, Gary Chu, will tell you about the new George Clooney vehicle set in Hawaii called The Descendants. And now, as we span the globe to bring you the news that other outlets don't cover, let's go to the northeast corner of the Indian Ocean, to the Gulf of Aden, off the coast of Somalia, where in recent years, pirates have garnered a great deal of international attention as they grab ships and hold them for ransom. And in the American media, we've gotten a pretty crappy one-dimensional picture of the situation there. And I'm grateful to Canadian journalist Jay Bahadur, who has published a book this year called The Pirates of Somalia, Inside Their Hidden World. Jay, welcome to the Peter B. Collins Show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I don't know if you can recognize that music, but I found it online. It's Somali Mustafa.
Somali Mustafa?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like any Somali music I've heard. Somali music is kind of reggae-like, but...
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it actually sounds a lot like reggae, and it usually has choruses of men and women singing back and forth to each other over it. I've certainly never heard that before.
Well, this is almost unpronounceable, but Somali Mustafa's CD is called Zebeklerimiz, and that tune was called Yandem Ayse. And I'm sure as it's transmogrified into English, a lot is lost.
Yeah, I'll look it up.
Well, Jay, as I mentioned, the American media really has given us a very limited picture of what has been going on off the coast of Somalia. And, you know, we hear news accounts of these various incidents and demands for ransom, a lot of outrage expressed on the part of Western governments and seafaring nations. But your book really reveals many layers that have produced this unusual development of fairly rampant piracy in the Gulf of Aden. And if I may start, I will let you talk, but I want to read a couple of passages from your book because you summarize this very well. You say, four main causes explain the rise of piracy in Puntland: geopolitics, environmental factors, economic adversity, and breakdown of governance. So why don't we start with the last one? When was the last time Somalia had a functioning government?
Well, it was, you know, around 1991 that the civil war really caused the central government, at least, to collapse. And there hasn't been a functioning central government in place since then.
Mm-hmm.
But what a lot of people don't know is there are actually a lot of mini-states within Somalia that have, one to the northwest is called Somaliland. It's actually declared independence as an independent state. And then there are a number of others which kind of have carved out their little niches as autonomous regions. And one of these was Puntland, where I ended up spending 3 months in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And Puntland has had a government in place for since 1998. And this government is not really what you can consider a, maybe in the Western sense of what a government does, but it did allow for a level of stability and peace that just was non-existent in the South. So when I talk about the timing for why piracy really exploded, which was late 2008, it was because the Puntland government, which employs a militia of about 4,000 or 5,000, completely ran out of money to pay its militia forces. So the pirates immediately had basically a recruiting base of young militiamen with guns and no employer. So, you know, they obviously found a different you know, employer for their skills, which had different applications besides just security.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that really explains why in 2008, the timing of it, really, because there's been no Somali state for 20 years. Why exactly did it take, 17 years for piracy really to explode? And part of that, is explained by the fact that the Puntland government just essentially stopped functioning in 2008.
And you quote Roger Middleton, a British think tanker, "Puntland was the perfect area for pirates to operate because it's just stable enough, but also ungoverned enough. You don't have the chronic instability you have further south. There's too great a chance of getting caught in the crossfire and too many competing interests to pay off," referring to the south. So give us a sketch of the landscape of Somalia, because your descriptions are rather stark.
Yeah, well, the northern, Middleton hit it right on there, by the way, and I think that's the central point. So Puntland, the northern, which constitutes about the northeastern third of the country, is essentially a desert. I mean, much of Somalia is arid and semi-arid, but in the north, it's very stark. There are few natural resources. There's some potential oil that's being developed, but few natural resources, very difficult to grow food. All of Somalia's exports really came from the south. They do export some livestock still from the north of the country, but traditionally, and still, the majority of the population of northern Somalia is nomadic and lives a kind of pastoral camel grazing, herding lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. So, with that backdrop of very limited options for people who live there to make a living, and as George W. Bush would say, put food on your family. You combine that with the lawlessness of essentially an ungoverned or failed state, and many people stop there and they say, well, these are desperate people who take to the sea because they feel they have no other choice. But there are other factors here that relate to the absence of a government in Somalia, and that is after that government failed in the 90s, huge fishing ships, including Japanese factory ships, came in and violated the 12-mile limit of Somalia on a regular basis. Not only that, you report in detail that there was a lot of dumping of waste and waste products, again, because there were no repercussions. People could ship their crap there and dump it in the Gulf of Aden without paying, without getting caught. And so this combination of factors produced an extreme desperation on the part of the local population. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think it's fair. You could illegal fishing, more so than dumping, but illegal fishing was definitely the original impetus behind this this whole problem. And it was back in really the early and mid-90s, soon after the state collapsed. But as you mentioned, really, trawlers and factory ships from Southeast Asia, as you said, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, mostly South Asian countries, came and started encroaching on the traditional zones of local fishermen. And they often entered into contracts with local warlords to provide security on the decks of the ships. They would constantly run over local gear. When I spoke to the townspeople of Ale, which was one of these early pirate bases, they told me, a story where two lobster divers were actually swept up in a trawler net and were drowned.
Mm-hmm.
And so illegal fishing was essentially caused a backlash among local fishermen, many of whom were central characters in my book, including one very intimidating giant. strength of a man named Boya.
Mm-hmm.
And Boya and his men initially started by attacking these illegal fishing ships. And it wasn't until years later, though, that their skills were then transferred to hijacking commercial ships. They tell me it's because illegal fishing ships became too well-armed. We're all carrying anti-aircraft guns and so on. But partly, I mean, part of the truth is that commercial ships were just a lot more lucrative.
Well, and Jay, what I take a moment here, because what I think is really valuable about your book is that you really explore these various drivers of the development of piracy in the area. But you're also honest about the kind of evolving rationalizations offered on the part of the or by the pirates to explain their behavior, and you don't buy it, right? You say initially you can see that they did have grievances and there was no government to go to express them and defend their interests. But after the initial phase, it kind of changed.
Yeah, and I talk about this a lot in the book, that I think while poverty and illegal fishing were underlying factors, there was a reason that it took almost 20 years for piracy to really explode, and that was because there was a very simple reason. A former civil servant named Mohamed Afwene returned to his homeland in central Somalia and essentially invented this modern business. He looked out and said, well, okay, nothing can stop us from hijacking these ships. Instead of just ransacking the ships and stealing the goods and the catch and so on, which a lot of these early attacks, that was the form they took. He said, why don't we just kidnap the crew? And that's the current business model. It's just kidnapping at sea. And once he organized his gangs, and he actually began by attacking World Food Program transports, taking aid to his own people in the south. So you can tell that, to claim that their sole rationale is to fight illegal fishing is completely disingenuous. And once Mohamed Afwene had invented this model, a lot of these early fishermen pirates who had the experience and knew how to navigate at sea and so on went up and down the coast training new pirate recruits. Until at this point, it's just become a business. And really the original impetus has been buried in quest for money now.
And Jay, I don't know that you have an MBA, but I was fascinated by the business angle that you took in analyzing the operations. You basically refer to pirates as investors or the people they hire to execute the operations. And you have a Freakonomics section in the book where you analyze, the revenues that came in and the costs of the land bruisers and all the cot drugs that they supply their pirates with. And so talk a little bit about the business angle, because I think that's a fascinating way to analyze this.
Yeah, right. And I also became fascinated with actually breaking down the finances. And you mentioned the Freakonomics section, where I actually went and tried to break down the gang's balance sheet and its payroll and so on. That was the funnest part of the book for me. And it became clear, Afwene, who was, as I mentioned, this former civil servant who created the modern business model, he treated it very much like he was a shareholder, sort of a head, almost like he was launching an IPO. He went around collecting their shares from investors, would note how much they had invested, and then the investors would, he then would organize the crew. The crew would go out on a on spec basis, i.e., if they don't capture a ship, they're not paid.
Mm-hmm.
And then of the money that they ransomed the ship for, the investors would get between 30% and 50%. While Afwene was kind of the financial officer as well, he would pay for all the operating expenses during the captivity of the ship and the supplying of the ship and so on. And as you say, providing his pirates with drugs and so on. That was actually the number one expense. Which I was shocked to find that during a case study of a ship that I carried out in this Freakonomics chapter, I found that 50% of the $230,000 estimated that they spent supplying the ship when it was being held for 2 months went to this drug, cot, which mm-hmm. is just this leafy narcotic that the pirates are almost universally addicted to. another very, I think, very interesting conclusion that I drew from this Freakonomics chapter was that it was the investors making the big bucks, and the vast majority of the young guys who were out there in the trenches made very little. And this went against the stereotype, I think, that was being portrayed up to this point, that piracy turns your average Somali teenager into a millionaire overnight. But when the gangs are 35, 50, even sometimes over 100 strong, even a couple million-dollar ransom, when it's being split up among these young guys, doesn't go very far.
Well, and Jay, I was fascinated by the Somali equivalent of the payday loan. You described that once they have grabbed a ship, but before the ransom has been paid, the raiding party, the attackers, get to come off the ship, and then basically just guards hold the people hostage waiting for the ransom payment to be made. And as these guys come back to shore, they're already spending the money, even though a ransom deal hasn't even been secured.
Right. And, that was one of the most fascinating elements of it, that they had their creditors on land who were willing to extend them credit based on, the odds of them getting the ransom payment. But obviously it's a very risky proposition for them. So they end up, these creditors charge these young kids 100% interest. So as you say, these members of the attacking team, the ones who actually went out and captured the ship, in this case study that I did, they made about $40,000 each.
Mm-hmm.
But they got on shore. They'd done their job. They'd just carried out the seaborne equivalent of a high speed chase. Had risked their lives, got the ship, brought it back. They don't want to sit there guarding it for months. So they want a car immediately. This is another one of their very common purchases, is a used Land Cruiser for a pirate.
Yeah, and I call them the Toyota Land Bruiser, but in certain parts of the world, it really is the status symbol. You don't need a Rolex. You need a Land Cruiser, big 4x4 with all the accessories.
Exactly, yeah, and I kind of treat it as they're not so much going out to get money, at least from the point of view of the young guys. They're going out to get a Land Cruiser. And when they want this car, they'll say it costs $15,000 used, imported from Dubai. They have to pay 100% interest on that because they want it before they even get the ransom. So they don't want to wait 2 months, 3 months for it. And so the creditor will come to the gang's accountant, who acts as a kind of underwriter, and says, don't worry about it. Give him the keys. I got you covered. And he makes a note. And once the ransom comes due, immediately that, not $15,000, but $30,000 now, will be deducted immediately from the attacker's share. And so say he has $10,000 left. He might go out, marry a new woman, spend lavishly on her. He'll have his friends and family begging him for money for cots, this drug. And even in Somalia, that $10,000 is gone in a matter of a few weeks or a month. And then it's back to square one.
Well, and you describe them basically acting like pirates of the of centuries past. And a quick anecdote, I once stayed in England, near Dover, in the town of Rye. There is a place called the Mermaid Inn, and it's just a few hundred yards from the coast. And pirates used to come in there and count their loot and, recharge before they went out on another mission. And I stayed in one of the rooms where it actually had a secret passageway behind a bookshelf so that you could escape if the authorities came to the front of the inn. It was designed and built to allow you to just pull that bookcase aside, and there's a little staircase down and out the back of the building. And as your description juiced up my memory of that, because Somalia is nominally an Islamic nation, and you talk about these temporary marriages where one of these pirate guys who's just gotten paid will grab a new girl, break a lot of the rules, the protocols, not to pay the father for this new bride, and basically just party till the money runs out, and then the girl is dumped and the guy goes back to his original wife.
Yeah, and this is not this is actually pretty common across the Islamic world, where young people who want to get around the religious prescriptions against unmarried sex, will do these temporary marriages. Sometimes they're called traveler's marriages, where you can get married based on, you know, just verbally pronouncing it, and also divorce as easily. And there's actually an ongoing debate in the Islamic community, theological community, whether you can actually pronounce divorce over text message, which I find very interesting. But, I mean, these things are kind of in a gray area. It's not like they're commonly accepted. And a lot of older Somalis view pirates as corrupting their culture, because this is not something that's commonly done, these temporary marriages. And normally, as you say, you'd come to a girl's family, you know, offer a marriage dowry or a gift of a certain number of camels, for example. And the pirates just attract these women, as you say, you know, after a week they pronounce a divorce, and when the money's gone, and they go back to their old families. But it's seen, you know, it's kind of seen as a social black mark or a corrupting influence, and they're largely despised by the local people.
We're talking with Jay Bahadur, the author of The Pirates of Somalia, here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Jay, one other analysis that you did that, again, suggests that you're an MBA candidate, at least, is stunning, because you talk about, from the perspective of the ship owners, the cost of doing business, and that piracy is an annoyance, but really a minor factor, and it's cheaper to pay the pirates of Somalia a couple of million dollars to get your ship back than it is to either arm it up and run various risks associated with armed conflict, or to send that same ship around the tip of South Africa instead of going up through the Gulf of Aden and through the Suez Canal. So talk a little bit about that from the perspective of the shippers.
I think in the modern era, the media coverage is so intense that, you know, when you're seeing a hijacking happen every couple of days, as it used to happen, you get the sense that the Gulf of Aden is some pirate-laden death trap. And the fact is that still only about 0.2-0.3% of ships going through that area are hijacked. And so from the point of view of shippers, if you are hijacked in that very unlikely case that you are, you might be facing, in the earlier days, $1.5, $2, maybe $2.5 million ransom to release your ship. A ship probably worth in excess of $25-30 million, plus the cargo might be worth another $25-30 million minimum, and then you have the lives of the crew on top of that. So when you're looking at $2 million to release this $50 million asset and avoid, you know, bad press of your crew being assaulted or killed, etc., it was really nothing. I mean, as a business cost, it's a write-off almost. And hiring armed security, which, you know, costs in excess of $30,000-$50,000 for the three to 5 days you're going through pirate waters, really wasn't worth it. Now that's actually changing, because not only have ransoms crept up to about $4.5 million on average, they're also holding, the pirates are holding the ships for 8-9 months or more, whereas they used to hold them for 2 or 3. You know, when I was there in 2009, that was kind of an average captivity period, maybe 3 months.
Well, and Jay, it seems that some people want to blame you for the escalating ransom numbers, because you have published this account of how the whole business works.
Well, I mean, pirate negotiators have been driving up ransoms long before I wrote anything on it. And in fact, I mean, there's no secrets in Somalia, and every pirate group knows what another group has received. And essentially, because, as I mentioned, when they started out, 2008, 2009, when it really started escalating, the ransoms they were getting were really low-balling figures. I mean, $1.5 million, like I said, to release the $50 million or more asset was really on the low side of what they could be asking. And they learned this. And as ransom, as they set precedents on ransom figures, future negotiators would use these precedents as starting points for the next negotiation. And so this naturally drove the ransom figures up to the point now where I think they're so high, and this is what I was getting at just now, they're so high now, $4.5 million or so, that the pirates have, in essence, priced themselves out of their own market. They've destroyed their own business model, because now it is worth it for shipping companies to put armed security on their ships.
Well,
and
you just set me up here. I have a clipping in front of me from late September, Bloomberg News. About 1,000 former Royal Marines will be deployed by a British company next year to protect oil tankers and other vessels in these sea lanes. Now, I call these armed security guards, private security guards, mercenaries. Protection Vessels International, no indication it's connected to Blackwater or Z, will add about 250 guards to its existing force of 750. They say that an estimated 17% of ships in the Indian Ocean will have armed ex-Marines next year, compared with what this says is 15% now. So that's a pretty marginal increase. And check these stats. The article goes on to say maritime piracy costs the global economy an estimated $7 to $12 billion annually. And attacks rose to a record in the year's first half, according to the UN. About 23,000 ships carrying $1 trillion of trade pass through the Gulf of Aden between Yemen and Somalia every year. Somali pirates attacked 199 ships in the year's first 9 months, hijacking 12% of them, down from a 28% success rate a year earlier. And they say that pirate attacks globally rose to about 352 in the past year. Do these stats jibe with your knowledge, Jay?
Well, I think the main interesting figure there is the fact that success rate has dropped to 12%, and that is largely because of armed security. The reason now, I think this announcement about, they're going public about the fact that they're hiring ex-Royal Marines and so on, that's because the UK government recently came out about a month or so ago and changed its position on the use of armed guards on British flagged ships, saying that, you know, they're allowing it now. But the fact is, people have been, British ships have been employing armed security before then. It was just, you know, they were doing it under the radar, because technically, according to British law, it was illegal. That's changed now, so I think they're being a bit more open about it. But right now, I heard, just to add to your list of stats there, there was I think the commander of the EU naval force there recently came out and said that 90% of Somali attacks now are deterred by armed security. And there hasn't been one ship yet carrying armed security that's been hijacked. And so I think early on in the shipping community, there were fears that armed guards would lead to escalations, and that may still happen, where, you know, the crew might get injured due to some crazy massive firefight that happens because the pirates won't back down. Up to this point, they generally do back down, but, you know, that could change, and the violence could increase. We'll see.
Now, I'm a sailor, Jay, and I've never been hijacked. I've been boarded by the Coast Guard and people like that. And I find it hard to really visualize why these ships are so vulnerable to a speedboat or a Zodiac, maybe a pair of them that pull up alongside. Because when you're trying to climb on to a moving ship, it's very tricky. This is not an easy effort, particularly if they haven't thrown one of those rope ladders or nettings overboard that make it much easier to climb up. And it is very easy for a single sentry to stand at the gunwale of a ship where somebody's trying to climb up and just fire at them as, you know, because they have a hard time managing a weapon as they're trying to climb onto a ship. So can you give us a visual here or an anecdote of how these operations work and, again, why these ships appear to be excessively vulnerable?
Well, you make a good point about the size of the freeboard. That's the distance between the water and the deck being very important for whether a ship is vulnerable or not. Generally, pirates attack in skiffs of two, so teams of two skiffs. And these skiffs generally have a maximum speed of, you know, 20, maybe 25 knots in general. So slow ships are also vulnerable. Commercial ships traveling at, you know, 11, 12 knots or less are the most vulnerable targets, and those with low freeboards are. So what will happen is one skiff will approach the side of the boat. They'll be firing in the air. They'll be firing at the bridge of the ship with their AK-47s to try and get the ship to stop or slow down. And in many cases, the crew will slow down or stop the ship because they don't want to be shot at anymore. One skiff will approach the side, throw a rope or aluminum ladder over the edge of the deck and climb up. And actually, the first, in order to encourage the pirate crews to conduct these somewhat lunatic missions. The pirate leader will actually award the first pirate to board the ship with a free land cruiser. So this is actually quite a standard performance-linked bonus for pirates.
Uh-huh.
It's an industry standard, in fact. And so the other skiff will hang back to provide covering fire in case the crew tries to prevent the boarding in any way. But you're quite right that an armed guard team is very, they have the high ground, really, in this battle. And they're very, it's very easy for an armed team to stop your typical pirates. And, in fact, that's why pirates will not, or have not up to this point, boarded a ship with armed guards. But as I was discussing earlier, it really comes down to economics, and in some cases to the laws of the country whose flag the ship is flying. Although, as I said, those laws kind of tend to be ignored or set aside in many cases. But as I said, it's becoming increasingly economical for shipping companies to employ armed guards, and that's again due to these skyrocketing ransoms.
And Jay, I found almost unbelievable the story of the 2009 episode where U.S. Navy SEALs successfully fired and killed a pirate who was holding a hostage, and that this shot was fired from either on a boat deck or inside a small boat. And to imagine that you could shoot with that accuracy on a bobbing, water-based platform of some sort and kill the pirate and not the hostage, I always found that one to be a Hollywood story.
Yeah, it is. It is becoming a Hollywood story, actually. Tom Hanks has been cast to star in a movie about that incident, and that was the Maersk Alabama incident. And it was actually three pirates who were sniped at the same time. So it was very impressive. And it was actually, as has come out recently, Navy SEAL Team 6, which conducted the Osama bin Laden assassination, was the same team that conducted that rescue mission. So they may be one of the most elite teams, I think, out there, which might explain their success in doing, as you say, conducting a very difficult operation.
And what was
that will be a Hollywood movie, I think.
And
you're quite right about that.
What was the approximate distance reported of the sharpshooter to his target?
Oh, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I think you'd have to look up. But
I think there's no doubt
that it was an impressive operation.
Well, I'm sorry. I think of that Jessica Lynch story that was concocted by the Pentagon during the Iraq War. I'm sorry, my bullshit detector went off on this one.
No. That definitely happened. Essentially, the commander of the Bainbridge, which was a frigate that was in the area and conducting negotiations with these pirates, believed the hostage's life. Captain Richard Phillips believed him to be in danger and ordered this team into action. And they successfully killed the three pirates that were holding Captain Phillips, and the fourth pirate, who was actually on board the Bainbridge at the time negotiating, suddenly found that his negotiating position had been, reduced slightly.
Yeah, leverage.
His leverage bottomed out there, and he was obviously arrested and recently sentenced to over 30 years in prison in the United States.
Jay, here's a story from mid-November, Dateline Paris. Six Somali men went on trial accused of hijacking a sailboat in 2008, holding the French husband and wife crew hostage in hopes of a multi-million dollar ransom. Do you think this trial is significant, and will trying pirates in other jurisdictions have any impact on the ground in Somalia?
That's not a new development. They've tried pirates in the Netherlands, in Germany, in the United States. Pirates are constantly being prosecuted in countries closer to Somalia, like Kenya and Yemen. I think the French prosecution has been in the works for a very long time, and part of the reason is that their lawyers are and lawyers specifically for another group of pirates captured around the same time and brought to France have actually made an application to the European Court of Human Rights, which is why a lot of Western countries don't want anything to do with prosecuting pirates, because there are human or a lot of legal issues with whether they have jurisdiction to prosecute them, whether Are you going to send them back to Somalia? What, you know, incarcerating them away from their families? You know, there are human rights issues involved with that. So a lot of European countries don't want to touch Somali pirates with a 10-foot pole. Britain, as well, has essentially refused to prosecute pirates because I think the Foreign Office came out and said that they could actually claim asylum in Britain. So no one wants to actually have to rehabilitate and these pirates after they're released from prison and so on. So, but more locally, they are conducting prosecutions and sentencing these people to prison. But the problem is, you're really just kidnapping the workers, right? Or not kidnapping. You're really just prosecuting the workers. And in essence, as long as you have the same conditions on land, and you have these financiers who are, have the money, have hold the purse strings, and are have essentially a limitless recruiting pool from which to choose, it's not really going to address the main problem. And you know, a lot of pirates would be happy to leave Somalia. And I interviewed a few of the prisoners in Kenya during my research for the book. And this was the most inept group of pirates. This was early on in 2006. They had jumped from boat to boat, attempting to hijack ships, finally hijacked this small Indian trading ship and tried to use it to hijack a bigger commercial vessel. They bumbled it. They failed, were arrested by a U.S. warship, handed over to Kenya, and sentenced to four years or something. And after that, they were going to get Kenyan citizenship and be allowed to stay in Kenya. And you mean to me, that's, and to them probably, that's a much better prize than the few piddling thousands they may have earned for a piracy mission and then blown, you know, within a couple of weeks of getting back to land. So, you know, it's not really that credible a threat being prosecuted abroad, and I don't really think it addresses the root issue.
Well, Jay, I want to thank you for a fascinating book, and you put yourself at some risk. You covered the story in ways that highly paid correspondents in the United States wouldn't bother to attempt, and I really learned a lot from your book. I'm grateful for it.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
And tell our listeners you will continue covering this region. You're going to be editing the Somalia Report, is that right?
Yeah, there's actually Robert Young Pelton, who's quite a famous international journalist and adventurer and has done very similar ventures in Iraq and Afghanistan, about 8 months ago founded a website called Somalia Report that has employs about 100 local stringers in Somalia, and in my opinion is by far the best source of news of information coming out of that country. And he generously offered me this position as to take over as the managing editor. So, yeah, I'll be moving to Nairobi in about a month, and looking forward to it.
And I just noted here on your the blurb sheet that came with your book that you have a blog. I'll put a link up to it in the show file with this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Do you plan to continue blogging when you move to Kenya?
You know, I'm going to be writing for the site. I'll see how much time I have to devote just to piracy. But I imagine the blog might suffer a bit. But by all means, put it up.
Okay. The Pirates of Somalia, soon to be a Tom Hanks major motion picture. Down the road, I'm sure Disneyland will have a ride. Jay Bahadur, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
And now Gary Chu, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, shares his review of George Clooney's new film, The Descendants.
What's a dashing Hollywood liberal doing in a movie for which Kelsey Grammer might have been better suited? Hopefully the answer won't take long. George Clooney goes Republican, almost. In his anguished but still kind of cute role playing a middle-aged guy about to become a widower, but not yet, he resembles President Obama, a very nice, smart, successful man with two lovely daughters, but unfortunately a wife who's hanging to life by the very threat of a deep coma after traumatizing her skull water sporting. Matt King, that's Clooney, has just gotten the news from his wife's physician that the prognosis is grave. No chance for pulling out of the deep slumber. The doctor advises that Matt quietly and appropriately inform friends and family members, close and extended, that the end is soon, and if any wish to visit Elizabeth's room for last moments with her, it's certainly recommended. The King character was described by early promotional material for The Descendants as a land baron from a multi-generational family. King, who has the same name as the fabled and legendary but real ranch and oil family of South Texas, Kingsville and all, seems less a land baron than a cool dad prone to at-home foibles with his teenage daughter and her little sister. The land baron seems more like a really wealthy, nice, and endearing guy. Hey, sort of like George Clooney, but with kids. President Obama should like this movie, but wait, there's more. Matt King and his family are longtime native Hawaiians with Caucasian ancestry. You know, Hawaii, our 50th state, where some still don't believe that the president was born? What a great progressive film concept. Alexander Payne, Rex Pickett, and Jim Rash have adapted it from a novel by Cowie Hart Hemmings. Mr. Payne directed. He also directed one of my very favorite movies of recent times, called Sideways. So good watching all that California wine tasting. Matt and his family of cousins stand to make more millions with the sale of virgin coastal land on Kauai. They've owned it for generations. The possible big sell will take place soon after the Kings take a vote on it. Matt's the financial go-to guy for the Gilded King tribe, but such an agreeable and lawyerly money boss he is. The Descendants goes more soapingly operatic when Alexandra King, the older daughter, lays it on her father that Elizabeth, the wife and mother, was doing some guy right there in town behind Matt's back. Whoa, we could be heading 6 feet under here, but then the Descendants innocuously veers in the direction taken by Pulp Fiction. Not to worry, though, it quickly avoids that option, as the shaken Matt readjusts his thinking about stalking the guy who cuckolded him not long before Elizabeth's tragic accident. Matt isn't out for blood, though. He just wants to know what the guy looks like, then nestled down in his anguish, poring over why his wife could do such a thing. Matt is also enough of a putz to find out whether or not his terminally injured wife really loves the interloper. Alexandra, played by Shailene Woodley, steps further into the movie, helping her dad impart the sad feelings. Alex's super-duper dude friend, Sid, tags along for comedic relief when the going gets really grave. Nick Krause does the Sid role, entertainingly. And thank goodness we've got well-played Hawaiian guitar picking on the soundtrack. It remains pleasant and maybe a little too perky if you think about Mrs. King and the ICU. Exposition for Matt's character is underwritten early on by showing the relationship between him and younger daughter Scotty, played by Amara Miller. Miss Woodley and Miss Miller add spark to the lighter moments and are perfect to feel sympathy for during the unhappy ones, not unlike Mr. Clooney in his role, in case you haven't figured that out. But wait, there's a hippie cousin in the King family who's as rich as anybody else, even though he has long hair. Cousin Hugh is played by Beau Bridges in that come-what-may, laissez-faire kind of Bridges fashion Beau and his little bro Jeff do so well. All that liberalness they get from their late great father, actor Lloyd Bridges, it's been told. More than Sideways, I'd align the Descendants closer to a film that Alexander Payne didn't help write or direct. Have you ever seen Kevin Kline and Kristen Scott Thomas in Life is a House? Both Life and the Descendants wallow excessively in death in a comfortable family, covert sex, and the kids. Each film shot next to that wide and beautiful Pacific Ocean that sits off the coasts of Hawaii and California, where Barack Obama and Richard Nixon were born, respectively. If you can't afford a week in Hawaii, purchasing an admission to see the Descendants might do the trick. In that event, the film would also act as a marvelous travelogue. Lovely scenery. Check out the guy with his voice's other film reviews at TulsaTVMemories.com or IMDb.com. I'm Gary Chu, up, over, and down in the valley.
Hey, thanks for riding around with me. Somalia, Hawaii, the national surveillance state. Watch out, Big Brother is monitoring you.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until